This is The Deep Dive with Brooks Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
This is The Deep Dive, and yes, I am your host, Brooks Spector, as always. And we cover the landscape of issues. One week we may talk about a major production on stage, and the next week we might talk about dark matter and the search for antimatter. And this time, though, we're going to turn our attentions inward in South Africa just a little bit, and we're going to talk about South African, well, the way in which South African politics are covered, not the politics precisely themselves. And I'm really, really pleased and delighted, I think is more the word, to have as our guest this morning, Mandy Wiener, who is a formidable presence in journalism these days. Although I read somewhere that she started out as a traffic reporter intern in some station which shall not be named. But she's carved out an important area. She's written a number of books. Most of those books seem to cover the darker side of things, mining magnates who turn out to be wickedly corrupt and have strange preoccupations, or boxers that have connections to the underworld, or the underworld that has connections to politics, and all those kinds of things. But her newest book is about the formation of the negotiations to the lead up to the formation of the Government of National Unity. And as she likes to say, and innumerable journalists before her have said, that journalism is indeed the first draft of history. Others will come along and amplify it, or fill in the blanks, or add some nuance and color and shading and reorient things, put a new lens on it. But it really is important for somebody to get down to the business of recording the events as they happen and figuring out how the pieces fit together, at least as far as we know them. But Mandy, thank you for joining us. I'm really pleased.
Thanks, Brooks. Thanks so much for having me.
Let me begin by asking you, how do you manage all this? You have a family, you have small child or children, you have another job that probably keeps you busy 48 hours a day, and yet you manage to churn out these books and do all the interviews and make sure all the work, all the footwork has been done. Legwork has been done.
My footwork's not so good.
Footwork is for dancers, right? Legwork is for journalists. How do you balance all this? This is a question for those people in the audience who want to know how someone as busy as yourself juggles everything successfully.
Great question. So I do believe it takes a village. I have great support around me, people that help me with my children, a very supportive husband. It really is a village that helps me out. But also very careful diary management. You know what they say, Brooks, if you want something done, give it to a busy person. So this book was written on holidays when I had gaps, or in the backseat of a car going to a shoot for the series I've done for the History Channel, or in hotel rooms. So whenever I had a gap, I would try and fit it in here and there. But it does take a lot of juggling, and it's important to know which balls bounce and which ones don't.
This newest book, The Deal. Now, I confess right off the top, I haven't finished reading it yet. I've gotten about halfway through it, because there's a lot to digest, even if you know some of the circumstances and know a fair number of the players in the book. It's that you profile in their actions. One of the things that struck me is that, unlike most books about South African politics, this gets into the way in which people were thinking, feeling, and negotiating as they went along, which gave it a kind of a present tense flavor rather than the drumbeat of the inevitable history. And having said that, it reminded me a great deal of a very famous series of books issued by Theodore H. White, who covered American elections from 1960 to 1976, I believe it was, once every 4 years, this vast in-depth tapestry of things, but always with the sense that the inevitability wasn't there yet. Until you got to the end of it, you know, even though you knew how it came out, it still didn't give you the feeling of inevitability. And I think your book has something of the similar quality to it.
I didn't want to write a boring politics analysis history book for I wanted to write a book for posterity, but I didn't want it to be dull and merely analytical. I loved history at school, and I think that there's a way to make it engaging. And I do write in a narrative nonfiction kind of style. That's how I've written all my previous books. And I felt that it was possible to do that with this subject matter also. And I really like to make the point that, and I think it's so important, that this book is not for people that follow politics. It's also for people that want to understand how the politics of the country works. I try and explain the politics to people. And really make the politicians human, if that is possible, and get inside their heads. And I was amazed by how vulnerable so many of them were, that they were willing to share and reveal their innermost thoughts, their concerns, their reluctances, and I think a lot of that comes through in the book.
Have you had many calls from the people who figure prominently in the book, their spokesperson or their aides or themselves, saying, "Wait a minute, that's not how I felt. That's not what I told you. That's not what I believe. That isn't how it happened." Have you
No,
got some of those?
none of that, because I sat with all of them and they told me how they felt, and I hopefully reflected that. Also, what I do with all my books, Brooks, which might surprise some people, is I let people see their quotes and what I've said beforehand. So before it went to print, I gave the opportunity to most people that were featured in the book to see their chapters or where they were mentioned, so they don't get struck by surprise when it's on the shelf and they read about themselves. So I haven't had anybody phone me up to say this isn't how it went, because I've tried to speak to so many people and give as full a picture as possible.
One of the questions that occurs to me as I was reading it, and I've read a lot of books like this about this country, the United States, other countries in the West, countries in East, Southeast Asia, that some authors write their book and then they have a fully annotated copy with notes and further digressions and qualifying statements. They have that, they deposit it somewhere, which effectively means nobody can look at it until X number of years have passed or the author is dead or something like that, because the less than flattering, less than favorable bits of information are thereby available, but only to people doing research generation later, say, at Tales Out of School. Do you have a copy like that? Do you have something in a safety deposit box somewhere that's wrapped in plastic?
That's so dramatic. No, I don't. I mean, obviously there were things that were said to me off the record. I do have the recordings of all of the interviews, which I think would be great for archival purposes, because it's important that we record this. It was a seminal moment in history. It really changed the political landscape of our country. So it's important to have the record for history. Except, I did an interview with the president, and somehow GCIS managed to lose the recording. The video recording, because somebody bent the disc, but I had taken my own recording device, so I've got that on record.
Now, those recordings that you've made, the full texts of these interviews, transcribed and notated and notarized as of
Yep.
done on date so and so.
Oh yeah, fully transcribed. I had an amazing transcriber who, bless her, transcribed almost 100 hours of interviews. So fully transcribed, everything, all in the vault.
Okay, so that it is locked away. Historians get access to it 20 years from now. And then we get to then the final chapter effectively is written. Well, this is what she said then, and this is how it turned out now.
Yeah, that'll give me something to do in 20 years' time.
Right, because you can always issue a revised version.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it was interesting because, one of the books that I really used as a reference for this is Patty Waldmeir's book. She wrote a book called Anatomy of a Miracle, which came out in the mid 1990s, looking at the transition and covering CODESA and what happened in the country. And it's written in a very, very similar style. And it was so interesting to go back and read what had happened 30 years ago and the analysis at the time and her projections for what she believed would happen going forward. And also, of course, one of the key characters in that book was Cyril Ramaphosa because of his role as the ANC's chief negotiator at CODESA. So I did reference that quite a lot in the book, and that was what I was trying to achieve here, was I wanted to write a book that was a record of history in the sense of Alistair Sparks's Tomorrow's Another Country, or Anki Kroc's Country of My Skull, or Frank Chikane's 8 Days in September. It was those kinds of books that really inspired me to write this one. And I do hope that this book will be considered amongst those as journalists writing the first draft of history.
We're speaking with a very busy journalist, chronicler of South Africa's political evolution, Mandy Wiener, and this is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. We're going to take a short commercial break, and then we'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector. And my guest today, I'm really pleased, Mandy Wiener, her new book, The Deal. And I confess to my audience freely that I haven't quite finished it because it really is a big book, both in content terms and in detail terms. And it requires, you can't sit down and just read it like a Dickens novel. You have to sit there. It reads beautifully. It just is, it's detailed history in the making. And by means of that comment, by no means do I mean a criticism of it. I'm enamored with books like that, and I applaud someone who has the ability to get down to doing it as you have. But I'm intrigued by your reference point to Alistair Sparks' book, Tomorrow is Another Country, because Alistair was, if anything, a little too cheerful about the prospects of everything working out, that all the pieces would fit together and, there'd be the dawn would rise and we'd all sing and dance around the campfire, if it's a mixed metaphor, for sure, I know. A little too much kumbaya singing in Alistair Sparks's books for my taste, because he doesn't give you the contradictory views and the squabbles and the small-mindedness of some people in the process. And you, I think, clearly make sure that everybody gets not only a fair hearing, but they get to reveal themselves. Who did you find in that process the most heroic?
The most heroic, gosh, I think we're so cynical about politicians that we don't really cast them as heroes. And I think it was quite the opposite. I think that what I tried to show was the vulnerabilities of the various politicians, where they have flaws and that often their sensitivities got in the way. But I do think the way he portrayed himself, President Ramaphosa, probably came across as the most heroic because of the way that he tactically maneuvered the negotiations on behalf of the ANC. And I think a lot of people don't realize how involved he was because there was a negotiating team, a technical team that was involved. So I think the way that he used his CODESA experience to strategically run the clock down, to leverage his relationship with John Steenhuisen or lack thereof. So I think that he was pretty wily. And then the other person I think who was actually a masterful tactician in this was Helen Ziller. Her and the DA team, their strategy. And I spent about 4 hours with Helen Ziller, and she's a very, very deep strategic thinker. The way that she tactically looked at the negotiations as well, and she spent a lot of time explaining to me about how in politics, you need binaries and you need to create binaries. And that's what they were trying to achieve as the Democratic Alliance, and their approach of last man standing to ensure that the EFF and MK would exclude themselves. I think those were, it was a real privilege to get to spend long periods of time with these people and really give them the opportunity to speak so that we can understand them better and their thinking better. So quickly, so frequently we have these quick interviews with them where they are doorstop interviews. President Ramaphosa barely gives interviews. He doesn't do press conferences. So to be able to sit with him for almost an hour and a half.
There's an old saying in diplomacy, which I think applies relatively effectively to to politics as well. Diplomacy is the art of telling someone to go to hell so in a way that they will enjoy the ride. Politics, I think, consists of people telling other people both flattering things and unpleasant truths and having them successfully accept both. In a way that gets you fo moving forward rather than the other way, rather than into confrontation towards something. Who was the best of the people involved in this multi-layered process? The committees, the technical teams, the negotiators, the public speeches, the quiet tête-à-têtes over coffee and cake somewhere in the depths of a hotel. Who was the most adept at this?
That's a great question. You know, I think one of the unsung heroes of this whole thing is Phoebe Potgieter-Qobule, who really did the hard work for the ANC's negotiating team. And she's got such a grace and such a dignified approach. And, you know, the technical team of the ANC were people that weren't really high profile in the media. You had Fikile Mbalula as the Secretary General who was doing all of the public stuff. But really, when you get down to the brass tacks, it was somebody like Phoebe Potgieter-Qobule working with David Makura and Nkengkeko Kana. They were the people that were really doing the work and negotiating. And Phoebe does have that way about her. You know, she's got years and years of experience at the negotiating table and in the ANC's structures as well. And she is able to say things in that way. Well, the other thing that was really interesting for me was over the budget, the negotiations that were happening through the back channels. So Ryan Coetzee, who is a strategist for the Democratic Alliance, had a back channel with Nkengkeko Kana from the ANC. And that's where a lot of these negotiations were happening. And then I don't think, in terms of diplomacy, I think it was the opposite of what you describe. I think it all spectacularly fell apart, where they landed up screaming at each other. And Nkengke referred to Ryan as Desert Storm. That was the moniker that he gave him. But I think that literally was supposed to be the channel of diplomacy that was supposed to resolve everything over the budget, but in fact the opposite happened. So yeah, I think that's almost contrary to what you described.
That's interesting. I mean, the people you've mentioned, the small handful of people, you're absolutely right. They're not the ones that show up for the most part in television stories, in newspaper reports, but they function, I guess, since I was not privy to the inner processes, in a way that seems roughly similar to the way Cyril Ramaphosa and his National Party counterpart did back in the early 1990s. Back channel without a whole lot of public splash and dancing in effect on in front of the cameras, but figuring out the way in which you move forward rather than the way in which you demonstrate your side's rightness and godliness and the other side's devilry. There is a textbook to be written out of all this, I think, for politicians in this country. Your book helps that way, but it's possible that maybe there's a slightly more scholarly approach that you can adopt as a way of saying these are the lessons we have, or is that in the last chapter or two that I haven't gotten to yet?
Yeah, it's a little bit in the last chapter that you haven't got to. But I think what's important to remember is that there was no blueprint for this. So in many ways, this book will become the blueprint, but also the experiences that were had for this month in 2024, because what our politicians achieved in South Africa is something that hasn't been done anywhere else in the world. It's ludicrous the fact that, according to our constitution, elected politicians had 14 days to form a government. And that's astonishing when you think about a country like Belgium, where it took a year and a half. Most other countries in the world, it takes well over a year to constitute a coalition government. And the time frame that our politicians had to do this under was just absolutely nuts. Because you think about the time pressure, you think about the exhaustion, the lack of sleep, the different factors at play, the tremendous pressure from business and the markets and wealthy business people who are phoning all of the parties to try and to expedite a deal. And it's no surprise that this negotiation wasn't actually properly negotiated. They just came together to form the statement of intent, but I don't think the real minutiae, the detail, ever got negotiated. And I think that's important to remember. And this was all done democratically. It was done in a relatively peaceful environment, presided over by the judiciary. The police held the line, even though there was the threat of violence in KwaZulu-Natal and comments, inflammatory comments being made by Jacob Zuma. And in every province, we saw the legislature sit. We saw the National Assembly sit. We saw an elective process going through, and ultimately a democratic government being elected, and a transition of power from a majority to a government of national unity. And I think we don't celebrate that enough.
One of the things that does intrigue me a lot is this long term. Well, there are a couple of trends that are interesting. One is in the process of elections in the country generally, the number of eligible voters increases while the number of actual voters has been decreasing in I guess the last four or five elections for sure, national and provincial, local. But the question that the old identities, the old allegiances may be beginning to fracture and fragment, and that going forward, the politics of the country will look increasingly less like what has gone before and more like a quote unquote normal society in which the old traditional alliance and allegiance is less important than interests of voters in particular areas and over particular policies, regardless of prior allegiances. Is that fair, or am I reading too much into the tea leaves?
No, I think you're accurate on that. And I think we've seen that now, where you see the monolithic ANC that was so dominant for 30 years beginning to crumble. And I think that really shocked a lot of the people in the ANC, literally. The way that Cyril Ramaphosa described how he was watching the election results coming in, he said it was like watching a horror show playing out before him. Other people described the first meeting of the top seven as Ramaphosa being grey because they were so worried that he was going to resign because of how poorly the ANC did. And what that tells us is that this support historically that we've seen is starting to wane. You had people in ANC t-shirts walking into polling stations and voting for MK. Nomvula Mokonyane said she had to go to therapy because of the betrayal that she felt. So I think that's important to understand the change in the electorate and how they are beginning to seek an alternative. Many people in deep KwaZulu-Natal who have been loyal to the ANC for so long voted for MK because they feel that the ANC has forgotten them, has disappointed them. They're unhappy with the way that Jacob Zuma was treated. They don't feel that they're getting service delivery. And I think we're going to see more of that going forward. I think we're going to see a further fracturing of our political landscape in this country. I think we're going to see more smaller parties, even though we are now seeing some of the centrist parties coming together in Unite for Change. But I do think ultimately what we'll land up is c with constitutionalists versus anti-constitutionalists. And that's the way that our landscape will be divided. But I think that the ANC, which has so long held a majority, is clearly starting to lose support, and a lot of those historical allegiances have begun to break up.
I like how you phrase that, constitutionalists versus anti-constitutionalists, because that says to me that that's a trend line that echoes what you see in a number of other countries, not just South Africa. I mean, you see it in the United States in a slightly different form. You see it certainly in Britain and France, and you saw it in Italy and parts of what we used to think of as Eastern Europe, where the democratic process has become a fixed process, but the allegiances and alliances are shifting. You even see it in certain East Asian countries. In Japan, the Liberal Democratic Party held a virtual monopoly for 50 some years, and gradually has been forced into coalitions with smaller parties as pieces of it hive off and become very small, but influential in some ways, parties. Is this also a function, though, of the changing demographic of the electorate? Younger people in South Africa, at least, who were never part of the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s because they were children or not yet born, and who don't have that kind of warm, almost sentimental attachment to the process and the people and the parties. And now they are looking at what might otherwise be referred to as kitchen table issues.
Yeah, I think we're going to see that more in the local government elections coming up at the end of next year because of the growing black middle class in an area like Johannesburg, where many people who are now earning really good salaries have realized that they don't want to pay for services that they're not receiving. So they'll start to vote against the ANC and seek out other centrist options like the Democratic Alliance, Action SA, Unite for Change, because they want to see service delivery, and that's what local government elections are about. They're about refuse collection, electricity, water. And I think that with the growing black middle class, that's going to be an area of real concern where people want to be paying for services that they do receive. And I think we're starting to see, obviously, the younger generations coming through, they don't have those historical ties to the ANC that their parents did through the struggle for a democratic South Africa. But then you've got to ask the question about MK and why MK is so successful, because I don't think that's the pond that they are fishing in. I think that they are looking at, obviously rural KwaZulu-Natal and Mpumalanga, largely along ethnic lines, and the Zulu nationalism. And I think we can't underestimate that. I think a lot of people focused on this rising black middle class, people who thought that Songezo Zibi's rise in Mzansi was going to blow everyone out of the water. And it, as John Steenhuisen describes, spectacularly failed to rise. So I think that as the media, we tend to focus on that, but the real shift came from the rural KZN Mpumalanga voters, who seem to have tipped the scales towards MK.
The landscape, as you describe it, then, is people in suburban areas who every time they turn the water tap on and nothing comes out, or flip an electric switch and the lights do not go on, they think about the people in power and they curse their name. By contrast, in rural areas, the identitarian, the ethnic allegiance is, if anything, stronger than it might have been in the past. And if that's true, then there are quite clearly conflicting trends that are going to affect the political system and the political landscape going forward, rather than simply one trend line.
Yeah, I think so. And I think if you look at the analysis, like Davie Scholtz from News 24, I sat with him quite a bit, and he broke down the analysis of the results, which very much show that South Africans do vote along ethnic lines, and race lines. And I think that's important to consider. So if you look, for example, at the rise of support of the Patriotic Alliance and Gayton McKenzie, where we're really seeing the coloured vote going to Gayton McKenzie, recent wins in Soweto, large parts of the Western Cape as well. The same way that MK got so much support in KZN and in Mpumalanga, I don't think you can discount that. So I think that that's going to be interesting to watch going forward. So you see that trend, and then as you described as well, the trend in urban areas where you are seeing a rising black middle class that are looking for other centrist options. So yeah, I think there's definitely more than one trend in terms of how the how it all falls.
We're going to take another ad break, and we're speaking with Mandy Wiener, journalist but chronicler of the Government of National Unity, in a splendid new book, The Deal, that is now on bookshelves. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, Mandy Wiener, journalist, of course, but also the author of a number of books on the underworld and the demimonde, and most recently, her new book. That's kind of redundant, isn't it? Most recently, new book. Obviously, it's new. The Deal, which is a peeling back of the nice, smooth, slick surface to look at the inner workings of how South Africa's politics almost fell apart, but then came together to form a government of national unity. And she interviewed, I guess, almost everybody who was involved, and some of them for hours on end. The transcriptions of those interviews are going to be enormously valuable to historians in the future. But for the next little while, we have to settle for reading the book itself, which is now available on in bookstores on shelves as we speak. The Deal. Let me ask you this: was there a did your did the people you interviewed, did they feel, when they were being honest to themselves and to you, that there was a moment in time where it was all going to come unglued and things weren't going to go well, and there was really going to be trouble in River City by the time this happened, that this finished up, that things were going to go really, really awry?
Oh, several times. Several times. So there's a few that I chronicle in the book. The one is John Steenhuisen describes waking up in the middle of the night and turning to his wife and saying, "I don't think we can do this. I don't think we're going to get this over the line." There was another instance where there was a fight going on around cabinet positions where things really came to the brink. And in fact, Steenhuisen sent Ramaphosa a message saying, "Great doing business with you. Good luck. All the best. Like, hope we get to speak again in the future." So it really came down to the wire. There was another incident where Ramaphosa describes a meeting with big business leaders where they were trying to put pressure on him to reach an agreement with the DA. And he gave them a mouthful and told them to go speak to the DA instead of speaking to him, and sent them packing. So there were a number of instances where it really could have fallen apart. The DA was very worried about what the ANC's BATNA was, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And the ANC had two BATNAs. The one was a minority government. The other was a government with the EFF and MK. In Gauteng, the ANC actually went with one of those BATNAs, which was a minority government. And Helen Ziller says that shows that the ANC could only be pushed so far and no further. And they had to tread quite delicately. So while it did come to the brink and almost fall apart, it was, rescued at the 11th hour to try and get this deal done. But it very, very easily could have fallen apart, and we'd be sitting at the moment with either a minority government or with a coalition between the ANC and EFF and MK.
Well, minority governments globally, the track record usually is things work until there's a contentious issue, and they can't collect enough votes in a parliament or an assembly to pass legislation or even make appointments, and then everything falls apart. And then you have to, in countries where the elections are not at fixed intervals, end up you call a new election and everybody starts all over again. This country doesn't quite have that system. You have fixed intervals for elections, but if it had fallen apart, what would have, and it had become a minority government, that would have been such a fragile set of circumstances that it would be difficult to imagine anything of any kind of contentious nature getting acted on.
Just look at the budget. That's a prime example where even though it's not a minority government, they still couldn't get a budget 1.0, 2.0, only 3.0 could they get over the line. And the DA was very seriously considering a confidence and supply model, which would have seen a minority government, but with the DA supporting the ANC when it came to big votes like the budget vote and appointments. So in a way, we kind of have that situation anyway. Even though the DA is in government, they're acting as an opposition in government. And this is Ramaphosa's big gripe with the DA, saying that you're in government, but you're acting as an opposition. So we have this unique Mzansi flavored coalition where you have a party that is in government, but they're still pursuing lawfare against the ANC. They're challenging national government policy positions through the courts. So it really is a quite a unique situation that we're dealing with in South Africa.
And that leads me inevitably to ask you, okay, what's the next chapter?
So the next chapter, I think the big question will be, will the GNU hold? I think that's going to be the question around the local government elections. I'm of the view that the GNU will hold because the alternative is too terrifying to consider for both the
That's a great
ANC
example. Sure.
and the ANC and the DA, because the alternative is the ANC, going into power with the EFF and MK. I do believe, though, that if in the next national elections the ANC falls below 30%, which the DA poll is putting it at, we know that the ANC also polls very, very low between elections. I think the ANC will do whatever it needs to do to stay in power. And if that's a coalition with MK, then so be it. A lot will also come down to succession and who succeeds Cyril Ramaphosa as the leader of the ANC. The DA also going to an elective conference next year. So does John Steenhuisen stay on, or does he get replaced by somebody like Jordan Hill Lewis? And what is his position on a GNU? So there's quite a few factors to watch out for going forward. And then also, we can expect things to get very messy around the local government elections because everyone's going to be campaigning by decampaigning their GNU partners. So it's going to be a fascinating fight to watch.
You got my attention with, and who's going to replace Cyril Ramaphosa? I stopped for a second. It was like, oh, I hadn't thought about that problem precisely. What's your take on that?
Well, Paul Mashatile very much the front runner, although he has he's got lots of skeletons. There's lots of problems around Paul Mashatile. The potential of criminal charges, his association with the Alex Mafia, the patronage politics involving his family that finances his lifestyle. So I think there's lots of questions around him. There's a push for the succession race to be unchallenged, but it's going to be interesting to see who the other contender is. Could it be somebody like Fikile Mbalula, who would be trying to contest? We know that the ANC succession in the past has been so just divisive and damaging to the ANC. So I don't know who that alternative is. Could it be the electricity minister, Sputla Ramakgopa? Patrice Motsepe has said that he's not interested, but that's going to be a big determining factor in whether or not the GNU stays together.
Well, you mentioned the DA, of course, and if Helen Zille is running for mayor of Johannesburg, which she obviously is, and assuming she is successful, she will have a deciding hand or a heavy hand on the process of who gets to become the head of the party that she is a member of. And I didn't say her party, but the party in which she is a member, which means you have outlined two parties, both of which have succession plans that are not clear and firm. And of course, in MK, since the party revolves entirely around the persona of its founder person, he's getting older day by day as well. And he's never really been a political detail man, I guess. The succession plan there is a question as well. What you're really saying to me is, I'm guessing that everything will be up for grabs by the next general election.
Exactly. Everything will be up for grabs. We've got another 4 years to go. So I think there's a lot of moving parts here. And I've definitely learned over the years not to make any kind of predictions, because you'll just come back to me in 4 years' time and tell me how I got it wrong. But I think there are a number of factors, but don't underestimate the pressure from corporate South Africa, and how much of a role it plays in the reform strategy, the economy, and pressure on the ANC and the DA to stay together and keep this deal going.
You just got finished saying that don't ask me to say what's going to happen, which of course is what I just did. And you kind of skimmed around it, but which is fine, because 4 years, a long time. A week is forever in politics. 4 years is an absolute eternity. What that does tell me is that in the back of your mind, there is a book that is waiting to be born, which is The Future of South African Politics, in which you take as the book you have just finished and released as the jumping off point to going forward.
No desire to write that book, sorry. No, I'll leave that to the political analysts. I'm gonna stick to, I think I might just write some crime fiction because it's much easier to deal with.
Oh, you would be very good at crime fiction. I gather it seems to me you've got this easy way to understand the machinations and the wiles of the criminal class. It's not that you sympathize with them, but that you see them for what they are rather than what they want you to believe that they are. And you can take, if you wrote a crime stroke political crime novel, we'd all be sitting here trying to figure out who is which character in real life, of course. You know,
I've
who is
always
the
wanted to
model?
write a, I've always wanted to write a book that's fiction, but using entirely real stories that I've reported on, and see if people can work it out.
Yeah, well, you'll have to issue a prize for the person who gets all the players right, you know, win something. What is next on your agenda besides this potential criminal stroke political horror tale that you're going to write? What are you, aside from your work, aside from family, what's the next book in your
No, I
mind
can't
that
think
you?
about that yet. I've just finished this one, and people don't realize how taxing writing a book is, and how consuming it can be. So I'm taking a break from books for a little bit. I want to read more books, and spend some time watching Netflix series and reading, and not having a deadline hanging over me. I do a daily radio show. I do a lot of corporate work. I do keynotes at conferences, media training. So that really keeps me busy. So I'm going to focus on that for the next little while.
And your family remembers your name with all that work
Oh
done?
yeah, I'm still pretty present. Don't worry. I still do school runs. I still go watch cricket matches and hip hop concerts, and I'm as involved as I can be. But yeah, I've somehow still managed to get it all balanced out.
I admire your energy, and I'm going to ask for the secret ingredients in your meals that you take that keep you going like this. But first, we're going to take an ad break. This is the Deep Dive. My conversation today is with Mandy Weiner, journalist, chronicler of the Government of National Unity as it was being born and its difficult delivery. It's sort of like a medical story that was politics. Lots of nurses, lots of technicians, lots of people, lots of differing ideas about how this was all going to go. But in the end, there is, in fact, this government of national unity. We'll be right back after these messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today is the inestimable Mandy Weiner, who has just finished a book, The Deal, which tells us more than we thought we needed to know, but everything that we do need to know. See, I get the compliment in there. The Deal, which talks to the Government of National Unity and how it was born and how it almost didn't get born, and then why everybody now sees it as, I guess, inevitable. Do you think, I want to leave this as my last question, do you think politics in this country, that the arc of politics is, on the whole, is it getting a good reportage in the media in this country? Are there things that should be covered that aren't?
No, I think journalists are doing a good job. Obviously, a lot of the attention at the moment is being focused on the relationship and the nexus between politicians and criminals and businessmen. And I think the media is doing an excellent job of reporting on that, exposing it. I do think the Political Party Funding Act also helps, that we're able to work out and report on who's funding the parties, who's actively involved in the parties. So I'd like to see more of that happening, where we have more transparency around political party funding. And then, unfortunately, in South Africa, there's so much happening. The news cycle is just wild. But I do think that politicians are largely held to account, and journalists do speak truth to power. The problem is accountability and the lack thereof. So even I think our bar for politicians is so low in this country. All you really need is a 5,000 rand to deposit to be able to start a political party, some stupid number like that, have not been declared insolvent in the last 5 years or have a criminal record. So I do think that our bar for politicians is so low if you look at the quality of individual that is in parliament. And I think that's a real worry for us. I think that we need to entice people on a merit basis to want to actually be a member of parliament, but who would want to at the moment?
I'm thinking more about the way in which things are being reported, that there's so much concern with the momentary issue rather than the deeper look, the deeper analysis, but phrased in a way that average people aren't put off by it and want to take it on board and read into it rather than go right past it.
Which is precisely what I've tried to do in this book, is to make it more accessible so that people can understand it better and understand how politics works and how the decisions are made. We had this great debate in the newsroom, Brooks, about whether it's interesting to the public versus whether it's in the public interest. And it's about, as a journalist, getting that balance right of informing people, educating them, doing what's in the public interest, but being able to write it and capture it in a way that is interesting to the public. If you and I just did interesting to the public, we'd be doing Kardashians and puppy dogs. But if we were doing in the public interest, it would be a hell of a boring and nobody would want to pay any attention to it. So we also have a responsibility as the journalists to be able to do the important work and hold power to account and expose corruption and wrongdoing, but doing it in a way that is sexy and compelling.
That sounds like a topic for another conversation. Oh dear. It's been a delight to speak with you, Mandy. We've been talking with Mandy Weiner, journalist, chronicler of the way in which this country looked over the precipice and found its government of national unity in her new book, The Deal. I urge everyone to rush out, get a copy, read it, read it, read it, enjoy it, savor it, and don't take my word for it. Mandy thinks it's a good book too.
Of course.
This is
Thanks,
the
bro.
deal. No, I'm going to finish it. I will definitely finish it. I got about halfway through before we had a chance to have this conversation, but I skipped ahead toward the last of it to look just to see, make sure that there was a government of national unity. I wanted to check. This is the Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, delighted to have had a chance to talk with her, Mandy Weiner. And we'll be back again next week with another topic. I'm not going to tell you what it is in advance. You have to listen. 9 o'clock on Friday mornings and repeats on Sunday at 10. You all have a good weekend.